If you haven't taken a look at the disciples' response to the resurrection, you should be aware that the resurrection came as a complete surprise to them. They were not anticipating it. Despite the fact that several times during his ministry with them, Jesus predicted it numerous times. The Gospel of Mark tells us at least three times Jesus predicted it. And it seemed like it just went in one ear and out the other. And perhaps we can understand that, because if somebody said, okay, I'm going to die, but I'm going to come back 3 days later, you go, yeah, okay, right. Even though you've seen him work miracles, you've seen him raise at least two people from the dead, Lazarus and one other young man who was the only son of his mother. But what happens here at the day of the resurrection just demonstrates that they still hadn't quite figured it out, because it looks like, at least at first here, they're very perplexed and very confused when the body goes missing. I want you to think about three people today, and I just want you to see a little bit of the development of how they came to faith. I don't know whether it will encourage you, I don't know whether it will discourage you, but I want you to think about it in such a way that it took them by such surprise and with such force that it was the very thing that changed their lives. So we look today at Mary Magdalene in particular, and then Peter and John, and see the development of just kind of what's going on. Get a little bit of insight into how they came to grips with what exactly happened. Let's begin with Mary Magdalene, since she was the first to see him alive, it seems. Think about her life as a disciple, back a little bit further. And I guess part of what I'm trying to do today is give you a little bit of what I like to call the backstory. You know, one of the things that I see on a lot of the TV shows anymore is at some point during the show, one of the episodes or others, there's always a backstory. And the backstory is just as intriguing as sometimes the mysteries they're trying to solve right in front of them. All of these disciples have backstories, just like you and I do. We all have a story about where we came from, what our experiences have been, how we developed our faith. So we're going to look a little bit at the backstory of each of these characters today. In Luke chapter 8 and verse 2, we are told that Mary Magdalene had seven demons cast out of her. I really cannot answer the following question, except that it intrigues me. Why do the Gospels record the casting out of the legion of demons, but not her seven? You can imagine what it was like, what it had been like for her. I don't know if hers had been just as dramatic. I guess it was, even though the other is accompanied by casting out of 2,000 pigs, or, you know, them running into the sea. Maybe that simple little thing made hers, or made that particular one, more dramatic. But think about hers. Seven demons. You cannot underestimate the gratitude that she may have felt to this Jesus before he was resurrected, okay? And it says in verse 1 of Luke chapter 8 that she accompanied Jesus with the 12 as they went around the countryside. It says in verse 3 of Luke chapter 8 that she was one of the ones who helped support his ministry, along with a number of other women. She is probably not the sinful woman in Luke 7, but that doesn't make her story any less appealing and compelling. Mary Magdalene had a very compelling story to tell. If she were to sit down here and talk to you about it, you'd go, wow, he did all that for you? Why are we surprised that she spent the rest of her life following him? She is, in fact, as we've said, the first witness. She was accompanied to the tomb by several other women, as we were told in Matthew 28, as well as Mark chapter 16. Now, John only tells us about Mary. He's not concerned about the others at this point. He's not trying to ignore them. He's not trying to say they weren't important. John just has a point in mind that he's trying to get across. In Luke chapter 24 and verse 10, Luke mentions her, mentions Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and some others who were there. They were apparently going to anoint the body after burial, which is a standard practice, I guess, in those days. She appears to be the very first one who saw him. John chapter 20 and verse 16. But what does she do when she sees him? And I put that in quotes because Who does she think he is? She thinks he's somebody else. She thinks he's the gardener. You might ask yourself, or we might consider, why does she not assume it's Jesus? Because she knew it was going to be resurrected. And my question is, well, did she really think that was going to happen? Was she expecting that? And my guess is, no, she was not. That's why she mistook him for the gardener. It was a surprise. She was not at all assuming a resurrection from the dead. And when she goes back to tell the other disciples, John doesn't mention this part, but the other disciples do not believe her. In fact, Luke chapter 24, verse 11 says that she seemed to them telling an idle tale. An idle tale. Think about that. She's just saying something. They don't get it, so they just, you know, brush her off. That couldn't have happened. So, at least for Mary, this was a surprise. We've already seen that she saw him. He identified himself to her. She goes back and tells the other, and they don't believe it. Interesting. There will be a point to all this, but I want you to just see what's happening to them all. How about Peter? And what was Peter's life like as a disciple? We got a lot of stuff about Peter. I don't know if we would say today Peter was just, I don't want to say he was a big mouth, but he was kind of right out there, wasn't he? Peter was the one who always spoke up. Peter was the one who did a lot of things. First of all, Peter was a fisherman. Peter knew the value of hard and probably somewhat dangerous work. If you've ever seen the show, I guess it was called The Most Dangerous Catch or something, The Deadliest Catch, something like that. It's about fishermen up in the off the coast of Alaska. Now, Peter was on the Sea of Galilee, considerably smaller body of water, and whether it was as dangerous, we could question that. But fishermen go out no matter what the weather. They have to. That's how they make their living. If they don't go out, they don't make a living. My guess is it probably got some pretty big storms on the Sea of Galilee, and Peter knew how to deal with those things. Had he ever confronted the dangers of the sins within himself? There's another whole different confrontation, isn't it? John provides some very revealing facts about him. First of all, he was recruited by his brother Andrew, John chapter 1, 41 and 42. You know, Peter didn't know about Jesus until Andrew comes and says, "Hey, Peter, we found the guy that we're all looking for." So he comes. He is the one in John chapter 6 and verse 68, when a lot of people are leaving, Jesus is saying things that people are going like, "What is he talking about? That can't be true." Jesus turns to the disciples, and guess who speaks up? Jesus says to them, "Are you going to leave too?" And it's Peter who says, "You have the words of life. Where else are we going to go?" Give him some credit, even for his forthrightness. He is the one in Luke chapter 18 and verse 10 who wants to fight. In fact, what he does is, when they come to arrest Jesus, he draws out his sword and he cuts off the servant's ear. Peter's ready. Peter is a man of action. At first, we also had learned, I got this a little out of order, but in Luke chapter 13, verses 8 through 9, Peter doesn't want Jesus to wash his feet. He says, "No, you're not going to do that for me. You're implied is you're well above me." Jesus says, "If you don't let me do this, you have no part with me." And Peter says, "All right, wash my head and my hands also, if that's the case." So Peter's very forthright. He's kind of right out there. Now, John tells us in Luke chapter 18, verses 25 through 27, what all the other writers tell us about Peter too. He denies Jesus to the face of several people who ask him about it. Now, one of the things John doesn't tell us is that Peter goes out and he weeps bitterly after this. He is moved by his own cowardliness. Is that the word we can use for Peter here? Doesn't seem like Peter, does it? Because Peter's right out there. Peter seems unafraid. Peter opens his mouth. Peter's the first one to kind of get in there and let's have a fight about this. Several things happen after this, which we'll not talk about too much, but in later part of this chapter, Jesus reinstates him. Peter has this discussion about John, what's going to happen to him, blah, blah, all that kind of stuff. But Peter seems pretty prominent in all this. Well, how does he deal with the resurrection? Well, first of all, we know that Christ did appear to him, Luke chapter 24 and verse 34, eventually. But John chapter 20, verse 9 notes something interesting. He says, they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. At this point in time, when they go to the tomb and see the empty tomb, I just imagine Peter walking out and going, what happened here? Yeah, kind of scratching his head and just wondering, he didn't connect the scriptures with it yet. Something had gone on, but he didn't remember what Jesus had said numerous times to them. So he goes away just kind of scratching his head about it. Luke chapter 24, verse 12 says it a little differently. It says simply, he marveled at what had happened. Now, I take that to mean he was just still mulling it over. Something's going on here. What is it? He doesn't really know yet. I think Peter is at the very beginning stages of faith here. He's questioning. He's thinking about it. He sees something that he has not seen before. And that really strikes him as very odd, just like it might for most of us. A guy rise from the dead? I think his head at this time was swimming with a lot of conflicting information. Conflicting that this never happens. Conflicting that, but he's gone. Conflicting, maybe he's beginning to think about some of those things Jesus said, but still not making the connection. You know, his brain has still not got the circuitry necessary to make it say, wow, he really did rise from the dead. So he's going through this in his mind here. Was seeing the empty tomb enough? You know, if he really wanted and expected a revelation or a resurrection, I don't think we'd see him struggling at this point, would we? We would not. I don't think we would see him going, I don't know what's going on here. This is weird. This is marvelous, but it's just kind of weird. The women, they're just telling some idle tale. You know, we're not getting that. That couldn't be right. Hold off on that thought just for a minute as we look at John. He's our next witness. Because he was the one who came with Peter to the tomb, as we read it here in his own gospel. What was his life as a disciple like? Again, a little backstory here. I noted a couple of weeks ago that John was not just a poor fisherman. In fact, I like to think of him as really more of an entrepreneur because he left the family business. If you remember, Mark chapter 1 and verse 20 says that he had left his father with the hired servants. Think about that. What kind of businessman has hired servants? It's probably a businessman who's doing reasonably well. He's got not only his sons in the business, but he's got hired servants who help the business. So John wasn't just some poor schlob that was, you know, he went to Jesus because he's trying to get out of poverty or something. He didn't want to break out of that. There was something else that drove John, I would suggest. I don't know how his father felt about him leaving the family business, but you can imagine it's like, all right, I don't know what to do with this. I guess I got to go hire some more guys to help me out here. You're not going to take over the business when I'm done. But his father had a thriving fishing business. John and his brother James were very zealous and hot-headed. Jesus calls them the sons of thunder. In Luke chapter 9 and verse 54, when the Samaritan village will not listen to them and, you know, tells them to go away, they turn to Jesus and they think, the first thing they can think of is about Elijah. And they say, you want us to call down fire and destroy them? Jesus says, you're not getting it. You're not getting it. And they just move on. But that's who they were. John, the apostle of love, is a hot-headed zealous. We don't always connect those two things, do we? Now, in the account here of the Gospel of John, he tends to put himself in the background, doesn't he? He doesn't bring his own backstory out. In fact, he rarely mentions his own name, if at all. In other places, though, we know that John is named with Peter, James, and John, the three disciples that often Jesus brings along to do sort of intimate things, different things, things that he doesn't necessarily have the other disciples accompany him. So he's kind of in the inner circle here. Now, he doesn't record his own comments about what goes on, but John seems to remember much of the discussion about Jesus by others. We've talked about that in our Sunday morning class where we're going through the Gospel of John. He's got dialogue after dialogue after dialogue, and he remembers all this. I would suggest John was a very good listener and a good observer of things. Maybe he was just one of these quiet people who stood back and listened. Not like Peter, who was right out there in front of everything. For what it's worth, I kind of see that in John. Well, here's John also at the empty tomb. What's the one thing we know about John here at the empty tomb? He could run faster than Peter. Not a big deal. I don't know why John puts that in. Why is that detail significant? I'm not sure. Maybe John's just wanting to say, I was faster than him. I don't know. But the fact is, there's probably a reason why he put it in there. But the fact that he gets there first. But we do see John chapter 20 and verse 9, John commenting about himself and Peter, they didn't understand the scriptures yet. So John is very much like Peter. He's still going, scratching his head, and this is weird. Something's happened here, and I don't understand it. It sounds like he couldn't just project a resurrected Messiah either, as if it were exactly what he really wanted or could have even predicted was going to happen, despite the fact Jesus told him it was going to happen. He tells us that he wants us to believe, but this is after the fact. Later in the same chapter, he says, I want everybody to believe this. That's why I'm writing all this down for you. And maybe it's somewhat confessional. We didn't get it at first, but once we did, now I want you to believe it too. He provides evidence for us to believe when he himself had to come to grips with it for himself. I want to conclude with a couple of things and try to tie together what it is I've been trying to say about all three of these individuals. First of all, we would have to realize there was really nothing but the resurrection can explain why the disciples changed their lives so radically. Something had to happen on that day. Whether you want to challenge the issue of the resurrection or not, you cannot challenge the fact that something happened to these people to change their lives so radically that they were willing to die for it. And by the way, probably didn't get much financial remuneration for it. They most of them were martyred for their faith. At least the 12. John, probably not the only one who didn't, but all the others, we have records of them having been martyred for their faith. Why? What would do that? I would suggest nothing but a dramatic, powerful change and something so dramatic that it was just beyond the ordinary. We simply call it the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Nothing else really explains fully why they turned the world upside down with their preaching. It was Sigmund Freud in the early 20th century who asserted that faith was a mere illusion. He even went as far as to suggest that it was kind of a wish fulfillment based on what a person really wanted. Well, a little sidebar here. Freud was an atheist himself. And, you know, you can make an assertion about things all you want, but it's not the same as a proof. What I submit to you today is, did these people simply project a resurrection because it's what they wanted? That doesn't look that way to me. It looks to me like they got to the tomb and they went, what happened here? You know, they could not have projected that because in terms of a wish fulfillment, it was so far outside their realm of thinking that they couldn't conceive of it. That's why they had so much trouble believing it. And it wasn't until they saw him, and you had several different occasions of people who saw him. You have Thomas, who was able to put his hands into his wounds. People saw him. They touched him. They ate with him. But it didn't come easily for them. So it wasn't just some illusion and wish fulfillment, as Freud likes to think. After looking at the difficulty in believing the resurrection, I think that theory falls totally flat. a mere wish fulfillment on his part, I guess, that the resurrection isn't true. But we believe it is, do we not? The faith of the disciples came about because they really and truly encountered a resurrected Jesus Christ. He came back from the tomb. These people were changed. What else explains that? Not much. There had to be something happened that day. I simply say to us today, for us to reflect on, let us today rejoice. Christ is risen.